Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up on today's program, we go back in time for a look at some of the historical periods in which the popes represented not just a spiritual authority, but a temporal one as well. From the 1500s, we'll go to the years when Rome's Jewish community celebrated the election of each new pontiff, leading finally to the historic visits by two popes to the city's synagogue, and the start of a new era in the relationship. Raphael and Bramante, some of the most famous artists to apply their brush and draftsman's tools to embellish the walls and help construct the Vatican palaces. But just how did they become papal favorites when such a great master as Leonardo da Vinci got shunned by the papacy? Well, to find out, I dug out episode 29 in Jill Bevilacqua's series on the history of the making of the Vatican, Vatican Centuries. It takes us now back to the tumultuous times of the 16th century. Let's listen.
The 16th century opened to the clang of arms. Russia and Poland were at war. France and Spain followed, and later Turkey and Persia.
By the end of the first decade, there was a new king on the English throne, a young man of 18 whose name was to echo infamously down the centuries. Henry VIII inherited a peaceful, united realm of 4 million subjects and a full treasury.
The year 1513 was an eventful one. Balboa discovered the Pacific, and the Portuguese reached Canton in China.
James IV of Scotland was defeated and killed by the English at the Battle of Flodden.
Machiavelli was writing The Prince, and in Rome, the last humanist pope succeeded to the See of Peter.
With the accession of Leo X, the Renaissance papacy touched its zenith.
When Giovanni de' Medici was elected pope, it's reported that he said to his brother, "Let us enjoy the papacy, since God has given it to us." And enjoy it, he did.
The unique court of Leo X has been described as a society to which the history of the world offers no parallel. Sumptuous banquets, hunting expeditions, and colourful pageantry were the order of the day.
The party spirit caught on, and a carnival atmosphere reigned in the city. Chigi, the banker, invited Leo to dine in the loggia of the Farnesina Palace by the Tiber. After each course, gold and silver dishes were tossed into the river, to the amazement of the guests, who couldn't see the nets spread to retrieve them.
A true Medici, Leo loved the classics and enjoyed the company of humanists. He liked cheerful faces about him and was generous in his gifts. It's said that he carried a purple velvet purse filled with packets of gold of various sizes, into which he would thrust his hand blindly, for Leo was short-sighted.
Like his predecessors, Leo promoted the arts. He kept Raphael at work, painting and supervising the construction of the new St. Peter's. In 1515, the Pope had nominated the artist Superintendent of Monuments and Chief Architect of St. Peter's. Bramante, who had died the previous year, had specifically nominated the young painter his successor.
Bramante's project had been to erect a church in the form of a Greek cross, with a gigantic dome in the centre to be supported by 4 colossal piers.
On his death in 1514, only the 4 piers and the arches above them had been completed. There were many objections to the Greek cross form, so Raphael modified the square to the Latin cross. The rest of his contribution consisted in consolidating the work already begun on the new church.
In his celebrated book of the Lives of the Artists, Giorgio Vasari wrote these lines on Raphael.
While in Rome, Raphael painted a large picture in which he portrayed Pope Leo, Cardinal Giulio de' Medici, and Cardinal de' Rossi. In this work, the figures appear to be truly in the round rather than painted. One can see the pile of the velvet, with the Pope's damask robes rustling and shining, the soft and natural fur of the linings, and the gold and silk imitated so skillfully that they seem to be real gold and silk rather than paint. Then there is an illuminated book of parchment which is utterly realistic, and an inexpressively beautiful little bell of wrought silver. Among the other details, there is also on the Pope's throne a ball of burnished gold, which is so bright that, like a mirror, it reflects the light from the windows, the Pope's shoulders, and the walls around the room. Indeed, everything in this picture is executed so diligently that no other painter could ever possibly surpass it. The Pope was moved to reward him very generously, and today it may be seen in Florence, in the Duke's wardrobe.
In Raphael, Pope Leo had found an artist entirely to his taste. But Leonardo da Vinci was quite another matter. The Pope commissioned a painting, and Leonardo began by experimenting with the varnish he proposed to use, distilling oils and various plants. "Oh dear," exclaimed the Pope, "this man will never do anything. Here he is thinking about finishing the work before he even starts it."
From the age of the universal man, there can surely be no name which has come down to us with more clamour than that of Leonardo da Vinci. He was that extraordinary combination, an artist and a scientist at one and the same time.
Born in 1452, this illegitimate son of a Florentine lawyer and a peasant woman invented the greater part of our modern civilization. He foresaw tanks, designed the first aeroplane that flew, the machine gun and the submarine, the automobile and the wave theory of light.
As a young man, Leonardo believed that painting was the noblest calling that a man could follow. He was fascinated by the spirit at work beneath the world of appearance and analysed the objects of vision and the way in which vision functioned. This meant studying the structure and life of nature. Leonardo used scientific methods of research to find out nature's laws and introduce them in his work. This was not only for the painting of specific pictures commissioned by his patrons, but as a means of attaining creative power. And although Leonardo created few works of art, they are all masterpieces.
In Leonardo's time, there were no professional scientists working by experiment. He was the forerunner of a new age in science. He was also a civil and military engineer whose inventions embodied in elementary form the principles of modern machinery.
Leonardo may be said to have done everything. He was athletic, was specially good at broad and high jumping. He could play several instruments, though he preferred the lute, and could make them himself.
And yet, the awesome glow which surrounds the enigmatic master often makes us forget the contradictions and inconsistencies of his personality. His contemporaries considered him a trifler, something of a madman even, who wrote the wrong way round and dabbled in shady research.
Leonardo had been launched in his career by Lorenzo the Magnificent. When Giovanni de' Medici was elected pope, his brother Giuliano became standard-bearer of the papal forces, and Leonardo followed the Medici to Rome. Duke Giuliano was interested in art and science, but was weak and unstable. The new pope was a great student of natural philosophy, and especially alchemy. Leonardo had great hopes of his patronage.
But the two men did not hit it off. "The pope was indifferent to Leonardo. The Medici made me and ruined me," wrote the aging genius sadly. Leonardo's last dated note was written in August 1516, giving the measurements of St. Paul's outside the walls. In the March of that same year, Duke Giuliano had died, and with the loss of his patron, Leonardo's hopes of finding a fruitful field for his activities were shattered.
At the end of 1516, Leonardo accepted the invitation of the King of France and died in his arms in Amboise on May the 2nd, 1516.
And that episode was taken from Jill Bevilacqua's series, Vatican Centuries. Well, though we won't hear the names of such masters as Leonardo and Raphael in the next story, we will hear about how art was a link between Rome's Jewish community and the papacy. Let's listen. For centuries, the citizens of Rome gathered along the city's ancient streets to celebrate the election of each new pope. Among them were the city's Jews, whose community dates back to the very time of Jesus himself and farther still. Today, they number 12,000. From the 12th century, Rome's Jews, like most of its other citizens, took part in the possesso, or papal enthronement processions, which wound their way from the Vatican to the Lateran Palace. From the 16th century, Rome's Jewish community was responsible for decorating the part of the route that extended from the Arch of Titus to the Colosseum, both monuments full of symbolic and historic significance for Roman Jewry.
Throughout the centuries, hundreds and hundreds of posters were produced and exhibited, and we are lucky in that we can observe today 14 of these original posters.
Professor Amnon Linder of Hebrew University in Jerusalem had been researching the Jewish posters for the papal possesso celebrations for several years and had just published a report on his findings when he received a call from Rome. 14 of the posters he had been studying as copies or through written accounts had been discovered in the archives of Rome's synagogue, just in time for Pope Benedict XVI's visit in January 2010. He could hardly contain his excitement as he was asked to speak at the opening of a special exhibit of the posters of papal ceremonies dating from the mid to late 18th century.
The Jewish community of Rome had a role to play in the coronation ceremonials of the popes, at least since the 12th century. Our first indications are from the beginning of the 12th century. It might have begun a bit earlier, but since the 12th century, the Roman community actually welcomed the Pope on his coronation procession, which went from the Vatican to the Lateran, and at a certain point in this procession, the chief rabbi as they say, a multitude of Jews, a crowd of Jews, welcomed the Pope and presented him with the Torah scrolls. And the rabbi said a certain formula. The Pope answered, and then the cavalcade continued on its way to the Lateran. Now, this went on with, obviously, a few exceptions when the popes were not present in Rome, especially the Avignon exile. This went on until the 15th century. From the 16th century, the role of the Jews changed in this specific context and consisted in decorating the road where the procession went from the Arch of Titus to the Colosseum. This was a sort of a Jewish enclave. The Jews probably were not present there personally themselves, but they decorated the road with rich carpets, with poems of gratulations and inscriptions, festive inscriptions, and 50 posters on both sides of the road, 25 on each side. And these posters consisted of emblemata, which means a picture with a motto and a quotation from the Bible. These are biblical quotations in Hebrew and in Latin translation with a precise, exact reference to the source.
And what does this one say here in Hebrew in Latin?
Now, here you have the emblem shows the eagle looking at a crown, which is obviously a symbol of majesty, of sovereignty, the crown. The eagle itself is an emblem of sovereignty. And the eagle is looking at the crown, and the Hebrew quotation, appropriately enough, says, Hinei kanesher yale, eche kvazi akvila askendet, will rise up like an eagle. And the quotation is from Jeremiah. If you can look at this poster, for example, we have another one with an eagle, which was a very favorite symbol with the emblemata painters, and especially with in these posters. And you can see that the eagle is looking at the sun. He is looking straight at the sun. And this is a very well-known symbol of legendary ability of the eagle. The eagle is the only animal that can look at the sun directly without blinking. So this is a sort of majesty looking at majesty. And obviously they are of the same essence. That's why he can look straight at the sun. And that's why, by the way, the eagle was the symbol of the Apostle John. Because as we know, the gospel, according to John, starts with the divine truth. At the beginning was the word. I mean, look straight at the truth, at the divine truth. That's why John is always, till today, symbolized, represented by the eagle. Some symbols were quite simple. I mean, if the name of the Pope, like Clemens the 13th, was Clemens, and he came from the noble house of Della Torre, so obviously you can expect to find towers. It depends on the coat of arms of the new Pope.
I know it wasn't an easy relationship between the papacy and Rome's Jewish community. This was a sign, I understand, in a sense, of their loyalty, expressing their loyalty to the Pope, as all the other Romans were asked to do. Would you say that those times are long gone? We've been able to put history behind us?
Oh, certainly, certainly. What is striking about these encounter between Pope and Rabbi during the coronation ceremony is the fact that actually you observe a subject declaring his loyalty to a ruler. So the political aspect in this ceremonial is overwhelming, although it is also a religious ceremony, but it's in the first place a political ceremony. Now, the political aspect of subjection, and the Jews were subjects, like everywhere else in Europe, but here in Rome they were subject to religious authority, not only political, but an authority that was at the same time political and religious, which made things usually much more complicated than, let's say, in a medieval or Renaissance monarchy like France or England.
Was it the most difficult period from about 300 years in the 1500s to the 1800s?
It was very difficult. It was a very difficult period, but I must say that the medieval centuries were not easy for the Jews either. They were in a very difficult position, very difficult situation. They had to accept some sort of tolerant protection in order to exist. And this tolerant protection depended, obviously, on political, religious circumstances, on the personal attitudes of the reigning pope. And the situation got worse during the Counter-Reformation papacy. If you, for example, in the 13th century, there was some sort of traditional tolerant protection accorded to the Jews, which almost disappeared during the Counter-Reformation, when the papacy became much more militant on the religious front, obviously, for obvious reasons, against the Protestant heresy. And the Jews found it much more difficult to exist as a separate religious heresy within the very center of the Catholic world. And so, obviously, 16th, 17th, 18th century were quite difficult, quite difficult. I would say that even the very fact that the Jews did not take an active role in this encounter is indicative of this complex situation. They almost didn't exist. Their existence was a sort of virtual one, represented by posters, by decorations, but not them themselves. In a way, it's like the virtual existence, the almost non-existence of Jews during the three holy days before Easter. They were, as you know, even in the Middle Ages, well, beginning with the Middle Ages, they were not allowed to go out in the streets. They had to stay at home, not to, well, it was a measure of protection as well. But it is indicative of their difficult situation.
The difficult situation was not to really change for Rome's Jewish community until about the year 1870, when the Italian army declared war on the Papal States. But advances in relations between the Church and Jews have since increased the respect each holds for the other, leading to the visits by two popes to Rome's synagogue. First, Pope John Paul II, and later, Pope Benedict XVI.
The whole mode of relationship between the papacy and the Jews in Rome changed, as we have seen with the Pope's visit to the synagogue. Now, this was not a visit of a sovereign who comes to visit his subjects. This was a visit, this is a sort of relationship that exists between two very close religions, two religions that have common grounds and common roots, but the one does not depend on the other. And this opens the way, as the Pope said, of a frank and open dialogue between two religions that are, by definition, independent, autonomous, and therefore can talk to each other. And the whole atmosphere is completely different.
So your feeling is that we've overcome a lot of the differences, or at least we've overcome some of our problems, and we're now ready to face the future, putting our past behind us.
To a sort of outside observer coming from Israel, it's obviously not for me to speak for my co-religionist in Rome, but looking from outside, yes, that was my impression. And as one member of the Jewish rabbinical delegation to the dialogue that is going on said, it's striking, you know, the medieval representation of the relation between synagogue and ecclesia was the two women standing facing each other, the ecclesia with a chalice of the communion in her hands and looking straight forward, you know, proud gaze, and in front of her, the synagogue, a humiliated woman, her eyes blindfolded. She prefers not to see, not because she's blind, she was born. No, she doesn't want to see. And she tries to hold in her hands the tablets of the law, which are falling down to earth. The very picture of humiliation, of defeat. And as my colleague said, we heard the Pope actually emphasizing the importance of the tablets of the law, which are held in the hands of the synagogue. So this symbol obviously has been changed, and quite dramatically, when Christians actually look, I wouldn't say up to the synagogue, but look with appreciation and with respect to the fact that the synagogue is still holding on to the tablets of the law. And he emphasized it quite clearly, no doubt about that. Obviously, we have two religions, and each religion holds on to its truth, but relationships can be better than they were during hundreds of years of, not always, but very frequently, of persecution, humiliation. And now that we don't have the political aspect, the political factor in this relationship, I think that we can hope for a better future.
We were talking about Rome as an ancient city, and we were talking also about the painful history that the Jews here and Christians, the early Christians, had a very difficult time here in the ancient city of Rome. But sometimes I feel that people aren't ready to put away this past. They're not ready to sweep it aside and work together for a better, brighter future together.
I think that, on the contrary, you have to remember the past in order, actually, to get together and arrive at some sort of coexistence with memories, which are painful, but still they exist, and they make us what we are. Without our past, we won't have our present. And these memories actually should motivate us to do things right, to find some sort of accommodation with erstwhile enemies, with erstwhile persecutors, with erstwhile persecuted. Without that, we won't be able to do anything. On the contrary, the past is here to teach us what not to do and what to do right.
And a warm thanks there to Amnon Linder, a retired professor emeritus at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. That brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.